Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ira Melman, an effort underway to expand attacks on Islamic State. Western allies pushed ahead Thursday with efforts to expand an international coalition to fight Islamic State in the aftermath of deadly terror attacks in Paris. In a speech to Parliament, the British Prime Minister David Cameron made an urgent appeal for his country to join coalition airstrikes against Islamic State in Syria, asking, if not now, when.
I will not understate the complexity of this issue, nor the risks that are inevitably involved in any military action. But, Mr. Speaker, we do face a fundamental threat to our security. We can't wait for a political transition. We have to hit these terrorists in their heartlands right now. And we must not shirk our responsibility for security or hand it to others.
Cameron said U.S. President Barack Obama and the French President Francois Hollande have urged London to join the campaign. He said these are our closest allies and they want help. Britain has participated in coalition airstrikes against Islamic State in Iraq, but not in Syria. Cameron had said he would bring the issue to a vote, but only when he is assured the measure can pass. Meanwhile, the French President Hollande traveled Thursday to Moscow, where he tried to convince Russian President Vladimir Putin to sign onto the French-led airstrike campaign. Any cooperation there is likely to be complicated by Russia's own military operation in Syria, which is aiming at ensuring the survival of Moscow's longtime ally, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Russia has repeatedly tried to portray its military campaign as targeting the Islamic State group, even though many strikes have targeted Western-backed rebels. This is VOA News. The U.S. federal government is warning state officials they do not have the legal authority to refuse to accept refugees from Syria. This notification came in a letter dated Wednesday from the director of the Office of Refugee Resettlement to state resettlement agencies. The program chief, Robert Carey, said that states may not deny OPR-funded benefits and services based on a refugee's country of origin or religious affiliation. Any state that refuses to comply would be in violation of the law and could be subject to enforcement action, Carey warned in the letter. More than two dozen mostly Republican governors have vowed to block federal attempts to resettle Syrian refugees in their states, arguing they pose an unacceptable security risk. Turning our attention to Asia, the United States ambassador to Thailand says the country faces considerable challenges in returning to democratic rule with national elections in 2017. A primary concern, reports VOA's Ron Corbin from Bangkok, is the military government's use of laws that suppress public debate.
Speaking to reporters, U.S. Ambassador Glyn Davies said that while bilateral relations between Thailand and the United States remain strong, the Thai military government's restrictions on freedom of expression and its use of military courts in civilian cases is undermining debate on the issues facing the country.
We see real problems with civilians being tried in military courts.
Davies said Washington is also concerned over what he called unprecedented lengthy prison sentences for individuals charged with violating the country's strict lèse majesté law, which imposes heavy penalties for speech seen as critical of the Thai royal family. Ron Corbin for VOA News, Bangkok, Thailand.
Pope Francis celebrated Mass before thousands in the Kenyan capital of Nairobi on Thursday. The head of the Roman Catholic Church is urging Christians and Muslims to communicate with one another to guard against the radicalization and acts of violence in the name of God. Bridging Muslim-Christian rifts is one theme of his first tour of Africa. The Pope will also visit the poor and youth in Kenya Friday before heading to Uganda and the Central African Republic. Here in the United States, protesters took to the streets of Chicago for the second straight night Wednesday, a day after the city's police department released a video of a black teenager being shot to death by a white officer. The protesters rallied in downtown Chicago following the release of video that showed an officer shooting a 17-year-old black youth. I'm Ira.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight. From the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
In Kenya Thursday, tens of thousands of people, including the nation's president, came out to the University of Nairobi for a rain-soaked open-air mass led by Pope Francis.
That's VOA's Jill Craig reporting from Nairobi. Details next. Also in the news, new data shows alarming rates of child marriage in Africa. And Djibouti's president Ismail Omar Guelleh says the Chinese government is talking to his government about building a military base in the small Horn of Africa nation. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Douglas Mpuga sitting in for Sunny, music from Uganda, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour. In Kenya today, tens of thousands of people, including the nation's president, came out to the University of Nairobi for a rain-soaked open-air mass led by Pope Francis. VOA's Jill Craig was there and has this report.
Despite gray skies and heavy showers, Kenyans turned out in force to the University of Nairobi sports grounds Thursday morning. Some said they had arrived as early as 3 a.m. to secure their places in line, all to ensure they would be able to attend Mass with Pope Francis.
Wow, it's wonderful. It's what we've been waiting for forever. And I'm grateful to be here. And we will be blessed by the end of the day.
One man said he saw Pope John Paul II, the last pope to visit Kenya, in 1995. He and his wife woke up at 2 a.m. to make their way to the university grounds.
So we came this early so that we can be able to attend this colorful and most blessed Mass.
In his homily, Pope Francis extolled family values, saying that Kenyan society has long been based on a deep respect for the wisdom of the elderly and love for children. The Pope said, for their sake and for the good of society, our faith in God's word calls us to support families in their mission in society, to accept children as a blessing for our world, and to defend the dignity of each man and woman, for all of us are brothers and sisters in one human family. And especially fitting because he was at a university, Pope Francis spoke directly to young people. He said, "Let the great values of Africa's traditions, the wisdom and truth of God's word, and the generous idealism of your youth guide you in working to shape a society which is ever more just, inclusive, and respectful of human dignity." His sermon was well received.
I was very fine with the Mass. I'm very happy what the Pope tells us. So me, myself, I'm very, very happy.
Earlier in the day, the Pope met with leaders of various religions, saying that the God they all seek to serve is a God of peace. Pope Francis mentioned three recent large-scale terrorist attacks in Kenya at Westgate Mall, Garissa University, and Mandera, saying that God's name must never be used to justify hatred and violence. All too often, he said, young people are being radicalized in the name of religion to sow discord and fear and to tear at the very fabric of our societies. The Pope arrived in Kenya Wednesday evening for the start of his first Africa tour. While in Kenya, he is also expected to make a speech at the UN Environment Program and visit the Kangemi slum in the capital. He travels to Uganda late Friday and then on to the Central African Republic Sunday. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
France is keeping a high level of security ahead of the UN climate talks scheduled to start Monday. An estimated 140 world leaders are expected to attend. Interior Minister Bernard Cazeneuve said the government has deployed more than 120,000 police and military troops to enforce traffic restrictions and control borders. The security move comes in the wake of the November 13 terrorist attacks in Paris that killed 130 and left hundreds injured. French authorities have also extended a measure banning soccer fans from visiting teams from traveling to domestic soccer matches. The ban affects the Champions, Europa, and the French leagues and French Cup matches until mid-December. In neighbouring Belgium, schools in about half of the Brussels metro system reopened yesterday, 4 days after the Belgian capital was locked down out of fear of another Paris-style attack. In Brussels, 300 more police officers were called up to help protect city schools. Some officers stood guard outside school gates as parents dropped off their children. More than 24 people have been detained in Brussels since November 13th, though all have been released except 5. They have been charged with terrorist offenses, including 3 who drove one of the terrorists in their cars after the attacks in Paris. Belgian and French authorities continue to search for 2 suspects with direct links to the Paris attacks, as well as up to 10 other authorities fear could be planning further violence. French President François Hollande continues to push for a stronger coalition against Islamic State militants. Mr. Hollande leaves today for Moscow to meet Russian President Vladimir Putin. He has already spoken with U.S. President Barack Obama. France's parliament voted 325-0 today to extend airstrikes against Islamic States in Syria beyond early January. The lower house had earlier voted 515-4 in favor. Italian Prime Minister Matteo Renzi met with Mr. Hollande today and supports a broader coalition to destroy the Islamic State group. However, Mr. Renzi said that Libya must be a priority, saying there is a risk that the North African country could become the biggest emergency. As far as France gets ready to host next week's climate conference, some fear the Paris terrorist attacks and global security concerns may cast a shadow over the talks. One man, however, thinks differently. Lisa Bryan reports for VOA that France's special climate envoy, Nicolas Hulot, believes a climate change discussion is closely tied to issues of peace and justice.
In a few days, dozens of world leaders arrive in Paris for the key climate summit, and Nicolas Hulot, a well-known environmentalist and French President François Hollande's special envoy, says the chances of reaching an ambitious climate change agreement are still uncertain.
Dire que Paris, à ce stade, pourrait être un échec absolu, c'est manquer absolument d'objectivité.
Hulot says complete failure at the UN COP21 climate conference outside Paris is impossible, but real success will depend on a number of criteria, including securing an initial $100 billion in financing to help poorer countries adapt to climate change and taking the steps necessary to switch from fossil to green energy. The overall goal is to cut global greenhouse gas emissions to 2 degrees Celsius or less above pre-industrial levels. Hulot spoke Wednesday to a group of Anglophone reporters in a capital that is still recovering from Europe's worst terrorist attacks in more than a decade. The string of shootings and bombings killed or wounded about 500 people. At least 2 suspects are still on the loose. A state of emergency remains in place, and French authorities are stepping up security even further for the climate summit.
C'est un risque que le contexte sécuritaire puisse détourner l'attention.
Hulot says there's always a risk the massive security focus could divert attention from reaching global climate goals, but he says he believes the opposite might happen at the conference, since climate change brings new conflicts and threats, like massive population displacements. He says fighting climate change improves chances for greater world peace and justice. U.S. President Barack Obama, who says he will be pushing for a robust climate deal, has also warned a warming planet threatens U.S. national security and the future of many developing countries. In Washington Tuesday, President Hollande, during a meeting with Obama, said going ahead with the climate conference is the best response to the Paris attacks. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
The Netherlands may require economic migrants to accept repatriation before getting basic accommodations in the country. A Dutch advisory court says the government can offer temporary food and shelter to those who fail to meet the requirements of political asylum if they agree to be repatriated to their countries of origin. The ruling declares that denial of these services does not contravene the European Convention on Human Rights. In Germany, which needs to find housing for more than 800,000 destitute newcomers, about 50 concrete shelters are being tested in a city south of Bonn as a fast housing solution for Syrian refugees. A German daily newspaper reports authorities have ordered more than 2,000 of the concrete shelters. Each house can hold up to 8 people and costs between $10,000 and $15,000. The prefabricated concrete dwellings were proposed by Peter Jorgen, a retired engineer who used to work with refugees from the Balkan Wars of the 1990s. Jorgen says the parts of the structures can be built, insulated, and assembled in just a few days. He says the design without insulation would be ideal for climates the migrants come from. Czech President Miloš Zeman has told a newspaper that he considers the flow of migrants an organized invasion. Mr. Zeman earlier linked the wave of asylum seekers and economic migrants to terrorist attacks. The president has criticized Prime Minister Bohuslav Sobotka's efforts to deal with the flow of migrants and dismiss the dangers they pose to the country. Mr. Sobotka argues that they must fight the terrorists, not the migrants who have fled from the terrorists. Meanwhile, Israel is considering another wall to contain 2 months of violence in Hebron. Israeli Defense Minister Moshe Yaalon has announced the government will build a fortified fence in the West Bank's southwest. The fence would fill in a gap in the barrier Israel has built in response to Palestinian attacks. The construction of the fence will take a year. The fence design is the same as the one in Egyptian frontier, meant to deter infiltration of militants of migrants seeking asylum. Egypt is currently struggling to put down an Islamic insurgency in the volatile north of its Sinai Peninsula, which borders Israel. The UN Food and Agriculture Organization says a surge in natural disasters is a growing threat to food security around the world. It says climate change-related disasters caused $1.5 trillion in damage in recent years. VOA's Jody Kempower reports.
The FAO study says droughts, floods, storms, and other natural disasters increased both in frequency and severity in the last 3 decades. Senior Technical Officer Neil Marsland says the findings are based on an analysis of what happened between 2003 and 2013.
If we compare that to previous decades, we've had a much increased level of natural disasters in terms of number and severity. Basically, if we compare the annual number of disasters caused by natural hazards in the last decade with the 1980s, it was twice. So basically, the number of disasters caused by hazards, natural hazards, between 2003 and 2013 was twice the average number that occurred in the 1980s.
The study links the increase to climate change.
You look at the data on climate change, and there's a really strong correlation between that and the increasing frequency and severity of disasters, yes.
Marsland says ripple effects resulted in the enormous damage estimate of $1.5 trillion.
If you think about the agricultural sector, it's extremely vulnerable to these types of events. One needs to factor in the issue that we have lots of multiplier effects which happen. So, for example, with the case of the Pakistan floods in 2010, it affected not just people's livelihoods and killed cattle and etc. on the ground, but it affected the cotton industry, rice processing, flour and sugar milling, so it resulted in a huge increase in imports and a massive decrease in exports. So it's not just the immediate impact, but it's the longer-term impacts on the sector as well that make the losses so huge.
The UN agency found that flooding and storms hit Asia very hard, while droughts were especially severe in sub-Saharan Africa.
These are the main trends. We find that drought has a particularly detrimental impact on agriculture in sub-Saharan Africa. We've estimated that the total losses in crop and livestock production in sub-Saharan Africa due to major droughts were equivalent to about $30 billion between 1991 and 2013. When we look at floods in Asia, you know, we're talking about huge, huge losses caused by floods. So yes, basically we have that split.
He says 80% of the effects of drought worldwide are felt in crop and livestock production. The lack of rain can persist for many months or years. Floods and storms can cause a tremendous amount of damage quickly, wiping out fields, animals, and infrastructure. The FAO technical officer says, despite the scope of the natural disasters, resilience can be built into agricultural systems.
We have technology nowadays in drought-resistant crops, which are much more tolerant to the effects of dry weather on the growing cycle. This is something that we should be investing in more, certainly in relation to flood defenses as well. We know that the actual cost of investment is paid off several times in terms of the impact in reducing risk. Some studies have estimated that disaster risk reduction investments bring benefits between 3 and 15 times what they actually cost to implement.
The study recommends ramping up investment in disaster risk reduction. Marsland says currently less than 5% of humanitarian assistance is allocated to that. The study's been released ahead of the Paris Climate Conference, known as COP21. The summit runs from November 30th through December 11th. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
You were listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Twenty-two past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Some fear the Paris terrorist attacks and global security concerns may cast a shadow over next week's global climate conference in the French capital. And the UN Food and Agriculture Organization says a surge in natural disasters is a growing threat to food security around the world, and would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237. New data shows alarming rates of child marriage in Africa. That increase has brought together experts in Zambia to discuss how to end the practice. Most African nations prohibit child marriage, but experts say enforcement is poor and old-fashioned attitudes about girls and women still rule. VOA's Anita Powell files from Johannesburg.
Africa's population is expected to double in the next 35 years. And if current trends continue, the number of child brides will double as well, to 310 million girls. A new report by the UN Children's Fund says unless things change, by 2050, almost half of the world's child brides will be on this continent. The African Union is holding a summit on ending child marriage this week in Zambia. The Assembly will pledge to set and enforce 18 as the minimum legal age for marriage across the continent. Marriage before the age of 18 is actually already against the law in most African countries, though like the U.S., some countries allow teenagers to marry with parental consent, according to data compiled by the African Child Policy Forum. But that hasn't stopped more than 125 million girls from being robbed of their childhood by being married below that age in traditional or religious unions. Most of the children affected are girls, statistics show. Child grooms exist, but are rare. AU chairwoman Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma says cultural norms that undervalue girls and women are largely to blame. Experts say poverty and lack of educational options also contribute. UNICEF's Associate Director of Child Protection, Cornelius Williams, says studies show child marriage can actually be deadly.
Child brides are less likely to finish school, They are more likely to become victims of violence. They are more likely to become teenage mothers with high risk of being stillborn.
Agencies like his say the single best way to prevent child marriage is to enforce and improve educational options for girls, a move that he thinks will change the perception of girls' role in society. Enforcing the age of marriage at 18, he says, is necessary, but educating parents is also important. Here's how he responded when asked how he felt about the thought of his own 16-year-old daughter marrying at 18 years old.
My daughter marrying in Korea, I can't conceive it. I want my daughter to be able to determine the life path, the path in her life. I want her to be able to determine who she marries, what she wants to do with her life in terms of her profession, what she wants to do with her life in terms of any choices she wants to make. I will only guide her. And I wish that to all girls in Africa.
But he added, he's not special. What parent, he asked, wouldn't want the same for their little girl? Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Djibouti President Ismail Omar Gula says the Chinese government is talking to his government about building a military base in the small Horn of Africa nation. Reuters says Chinese Foreign Minister spokesman Hong Li describes the base as a logistic facility to refuel naval vessels. He says it is also to reorganize troops and food supplies for peacekeeping and humanitarian missions and naval patrols fighting pirates in the Gulf of Aden and the Indian Ocean. The United States and France already have bases in the country. Djibouti is a former French colony. Its port has recently been used by foreign navies, including China, which participated in the fight against Somali pirates. China may be extending its mission to fight terrorism following the November 20th attack on the Radisson Blue Hotel in Bamako, Mali. China's foreign minister says today that Beijing will strengthen its cooperation with Africa to fight violent extremism. Three of the 19 dead in the attack were executives from China's state-owned China Railway Construction Corp. Chinese President Xi Jinping has called for his government to boost security outside China's borders after the hotel tragedy. This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyi Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on the Voice of America. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to Africa News Tonight for the latest sports, features, and more coming up next right here on the Voice of America. For the full hour of Africa News Tonight, tune in again at 1800 UTC.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, after nearly 2 years of fighting the Ebola pandemic, Sierra Leone announced last month that the nation was Ebola-free. Guinean officials have declared that they will also soon be free of the virus. Join us Wednesday at 18:30 UTC when host Shaka Sali and his guests discuss the battle to completely end Ebola in West Africa. That's next time on VOA Africa.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joburg.
Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.
This is African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. In Kenya today, tens of thousands of people, including the nation's president, came out at the University of Nairobi for a rain-soaked open-air mass led by Pope Francis. And as France gets ready to host next week's climate conference, some fear the Paris terrorist attacks and global security concerns may cast a shadow over the talks. Coming up, music from Uganda. And in our feature segment, award given to individuals for their efforts at improving education in Africa. I'm Yehiz Wuhib and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with the mighty Douglas Mpuga sitting in for Sunny. Hello, Douglas.
Hello, Yehiz.
So what do you have for us tonight?
Well, Yehiz, we begin in Ethiopia, where the Confederation of East and Central African Football Association tournament is taking place. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The first ever game between South Sudan and Sudan ended goalless at the CECAFA Senior Challenge Cup yesterday in Ethiopia. After beating Djibouti 2-0 in the opening Group C game on Monday, it put South Sudan in line to qualify for the quarterfinals of the tournament. The draw leaves Sudan in third place behind their neighbors with just a single point so far after they lost 2-1 to Malawi in their first match. For more on CECAFA, let's go to Johannesburg and join Daybreak Africa's Mark Ouma with more on CECAFA. Mark?
Guest side Malawi dismissed Djibouti 3-0 as South Sudan and Sudan battled to a scoreless draw in Group C action at the Council of Eastern Central Africa Football Association's CECAFA Senior Challenge Cup in Bahir Dar, some 320 kilometers north of the Ethiopian capital Addis Ababa, on Wednesday. Consequently, Malawi is the second team to qualify for the quarterfinals after Tanzania mainland. They top Group C with 6 points. South Sudan have 4, Sudan has 1 point, and Djibouti has yet to secure a point with 1 round left to the end of the group contest. Staying with CECAFA, defending champions Kenya came from behind to draw 1-1 with Burundi in Group B action before Ethiopia outplayed Somalia 2-0 in Group A fixtures played in Awasa, some 270 kilometers south of the Ethiopian capital Addis Ababa. This win revives Ethiopia's hopes of a place in the last eight as they tie with Rwanda on 3 points behind group leaders Tanzania mainland. In Group B, Kenya and Burundi tie with 4 points. Uganda has 3 points, while Zanzibar has no point. Today, Thursday, is a rest day for all teams ahead of the final round of group matches. In Senegal, Nigeria's under-23 side arrived in Dakar on Wednesday following a 10-day camp in Gambia. The Nigerians played to a 1-1 draw with Gambia's under-20 side in a build-up match in Brikama, some 35 kilometers south of the Gambian capital, Banjul. Nigeria is in Senegal for the under-23 African Nations Championship starting this coming weekend. They are drawn in Group B with Algeria, Egypt, and Mali. In Switzerland, FIFA and the Confederation of African Football have set the 24th of June next year as the date for the draws for the third round of the Africa qualifiers for the 2018 FIFA World Cup, FIFA disclosed in Zurich. The 20 teams vying for the 5 slots allocated to Africa are Algeria, Burkina Faso, Cameroon, Cape Verde Islands, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Republic of Congo, Egypt, Gabon, Ghana, and Guinea. Others include African champions Ivory Coast, Libya, Mali, Morocco, Nigeria, Senegal, South Africa, Tunisia, Uganda, and Zambia.
Thanks, Mark. Mark Omar reporting from Johannesburg, South Africa. Still in football, my colleague Sunny Young caught up with our African football guru David Legg to discuss, among others, the qualifiers for the Olympic football tournament Rio 2016. Here is Sunny.
David, now let's go to Senegal, getting ready to host a big Olympic qualifying tournament with tickets to Rio de Janeiro on the line. How about a preview for our Voice of America listeners?
Yes, Sami, you've summed it up. 8 countries and 3 tickets to Rio at stake. What's going to be really interesting is that third-place match. Now, third-place matches normally attract very little interest, and I think they're a sort of necessary evil for the two teams, and so not something they particularly look forward to. But when it comes to this tournament, that third-place playoff is going to be critical because that will decide the third and final team to go to Rio. Let's look at the draw. In Group A, you've got Senegal, the hosts. You've got South Africa. You've got Zambia. And you've got Tunisia. And then Group B, Egypt, Algeria, Mali, and Nigeria. Now, the first thing I'm going to say, Sonny, is forecasting is a very hazardous business when it comes to this competition. Because in the previous one, in 2011 in Morocco, the rank outsiders were Gabon. Nobody, but nobody, gave them a chance. And what happened? They went on to win the competition and qualify for the London Olympics. And they were joined there by Morocco, Senegal, and Egypt. And it's significant that in this competition in 2015, neither Gabon nor Morocco made it to the final tournament. Looking at Group A, I believe Senegal must be the favourites. The hot, humid weather is going to be a factor in their favour. They've also got home crowd support. And they happen to have a really good team, as they proved at the recent All-Africa Games in Congo-Brazzaville when they won the gold medals. They beat Burkina Faso 1-0 in the final, but they were particularly impressive in the semi-finals when they beat the host Congo-Brazzaville by 3-1. They're a typical Senegalese team. They're tall, they're strong, they're skillful, they're very innovative, and I think they must be the favourites there. My feeling, Sonny, is that South Africa and Tunisia will fight it out for the other place in the semi-finals, with Zambia the outsiders, which I guess automatically makes them dangerous because once you write off a team, they've got that extra motivation to prove everybody wrong. But sticking my neck out in Group A, Senegal to finish top, South Africa or Tunisia to finish second. They are the two countries who would go through to the semi-finals. In Group B, the obvious candidates to progress to the last four are Egypt and Nigeria. And Nigeria, because of the late withdrawal of Isaac Success, he's based in Spain, they've called up Victor Osimhen, the star of the recent World Under-17 Championship in Chile. There he scored a record 10 goals as Nigeria went on to beat Mali in an All-African final to win the title for the second consecutive time. I've dubbed this man, Sonny, the black-gloved assassin. He wore black gloves in every match he played. And he also scored in every match, and he finished runner-up in the competition for the best player. So I think there's going to be an awful lot of interest in him at the tournament in Senegal. Egypt have also got an individual star. He's Mahmoud Abdelmanim. He's known as Karaba. He's already proved his worth with Zamalek in the CAF Confederation Cup and also with the Egyptian senior national team. So if there's two individuals we're going to be watching very closely in Group B, it's Osimhen of Nigeria and Karaba of Egypt. Mali, I think you cannot underestimate because they, of all the countries apart from Senegal, will be most used to those difficult West African weather conditions. Algeria, I'm sure they'll be well organized, Sonny, but their results both in qualifying and in warm-up matches have not been particularly impressive. So in Group B, at the risk of getting a lot of egg on my face, I'm going to go with Egypt and Nigeria to qualify. And I think if there's going to be a team to upset the odds there, it will be Mali. And I'm putting Algeria in the position of outsiders. So my feeling, Sonny, Senegal, South Africa or Tunisia, Egypt and Nigeria will go through to the semi-finals. And then it's a question of which one of those four fails to make it to Rio for the finals.
David, this week, millions of Americans celebrating the annual Thanksgiving holiday in which they count a few blessings and eat a little bit of Tom Turkey. In terms of African football, David, what are you thankful for in 2015?
I see two young talents emerging, Sonny, in 2015. Two names to watch out for. The first one is Farouk Mia. He's a midfielder. He plays for the Ugandan champions, and they got this really dangerous name. They're known as the Vipers.
so they're going to sting everybody in the CAF Champions League next year. In his latest match for the Ugandan national team, he scored a brace. Now, the thing about him, Sonny, he's only 17 years of age, and he's banging in the goals for the Ugandan Cranes. And Uganda, another one of those countries, are going to be in that group draw next June in Cairo. And I think for the future opponents of Uganda, the name Farouk Mia is one to watch. What I like about him, this guy, Sonny, he doesn't mess around. He gets half a sight of goal, and he just lets loose with that right foot of his, and clearly one to watch. He's a blessing for Ugandan football in particular, but I believe also for African football. The other player I feel that's done very well is Victor Osimhen. As mentioned, he's the Nigerian striker. He scored a record 10 goals in the World Under-17 Championship in Chile. He was instrumental in Nigeria retaining the title. And it's going to be very interesting to see how he shapes up now at the Olympic Games qualifying tournament. He's only 16 years of age, so obviously there's going to be a question mark about has he got the physicality to compete against players who could be up to 6 years older than him. My hunch is that he's got that goal instinct. He's got that predatory instinct. And given the chance, he may well surprise a lot of people and show that what he can do at under 17 level, he can also do at under 23 level. But make no mistake, it's going to be quite a challenge for him competing against players just that bit older than him. So there we are, Sonny. Two names to keep an eye out. Mia of Uganda and Osimhen of Nigeria.
Our football guru, David Legg, speaking from Johannesburg, South Africa, with my colleague, Sane Young. Meanwhile, the Confederation of African Football, CAF, has said the second leg of the Confederation Cup is set to go ahead in Tunisia on Sunday. Etoile du Sahel are set to host South Africa's Orlando Pirates on Sunday in Sousse after Tuesday's bomb, which killed at least 13 people in Tunis. CAF has brought the start of the match forward from 18:30 GMT to 1400 GMT at the request of the hosts Etoile du Sahel. The final is locked at 1-1 after the first leg in Soweto on Saturday. Sousse suffered an attack in June when 38 tourists were killed. And that's it for this edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. I'm Douglas Impoga. Now back to your highest.
Thank you, Douglas. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Friday, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 UTC right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, award given to individuals for their efforts to improving education in Africa. And next, international disability rights in Africa. But first, some music. Here is George Okudi of Uganda with Africa Higher, Higher.
Washington DC, America. Majimo Adikazioleki, feel the motion of the ocean. Mobimba, Zoto Toyokili Danda, Dar es Salaam, Kigali, Johannesburg. Répète-toi, répète-toi, la danse, la musique, Eza de Jésus Christ, Okudi Mwana Kora. Washington DC, hein?
George Okudi of Uganda with Africa, Higher, Higher. A U.S.-based child advocacy group has given its first ever education award to Mariam Mason Cisse in Sierra Leone for her efforts at improving education in her country. They also awarded Winfred Selby of Ghana for the empowerment of Ghanaian youth. From New York, reporter Bernard Schussman sat down with the two winners in New York. He asked Mr. Mason Cisse to explain her efforts at improving education in Sierra Leone.
So I run an organisation called Educade. I'd like to think in a sense that it's not just me, it is I represent a whole team. And what we do is run education programmes in Sierra Leone. So we run a network of schools and we have a significant now outreach programme of teacher training to other schools in our area.
You won this award because of these special programmes you've set up for young people.
Yeah.
Tell me about them.
Okay, thank you. My initiative is called the EPF Educational Initiative Empowerment. Amazing Ghana. What I do is that in Ghana, there are young girls that are not motivated to go to school because they cannot afford sanitary pads. So they absent themselves from going to school. Secondly, there are most young girls that are also involved in teenage pregnancy because during their menstrual cycles, they do not get money to purchase these sanitary pads. So some of them involve themselves in premarital sex, and at the end of the day, they involve themselves in teenage pregnancy because they think involving themselves in those premarital sex, they are going to earn money at the end of the day to purchase the sanitary pads for themselves. And school children also in Ghana, some are working about 7 miles to and from school every single day. Some of these children are barefooted. And whilst they walk barefooted, some are also affected by these soil-transmitted diseases. So actually, when I really sat down about this problem that is really going on in my country, what I thought was education is the key way to success. These youth are the hope of the nation. These are the people that we are expecting them to pick up the leadership mantle in the next years to come. But these are the same people that are facing these challenges in deprived communities. Then where lies the hope of the nation? So that was why I decided to put up the EPF Educational Initiative Empowerment. So what I do is I address these menstrual problems that young girls are facing. We donate to these young girls sanitary pads that will help them go to school. And we also give those school children that walk barefooted to school with educational materials. We provide them with shoes, school bags that will make school going very easy for them. Some of these girls, so we give them educational scholarship to school so that they can get access to education.
And you're a young woman.
Yeah, I'm 20 years of age.
You're 20 years of age.
Some of these young girls, when they see me as an inspiration because they were not expecting that. When I said I was 15 years of age, so they were actually not expecting a young girl to be able to pick up such a great initiative. So anytime they see me that I'm being able to, you know, provide them their needs, they are always happy. And whenever they see me, some of them, I'm a role model to them. They're like, wow, because they know that I'm a hope for them. They know that I give them voice because I'm a voice to these voiceless young girls in Ghana.
That was Winfred Selby of Ghana explaining her work helping to empower youth in Ghana. Africa has long been a tough place for people with disabilities, but, says the U.S. Special Advisor on International Disability Rights, things are changing. From Johannesburg, VOA's Anita Powell brings us this report.
At least 15% of the world's population is disabled, according to the World Health Organization and the World Bank. That's at least 1 billion people around the world. And says U.S. Special Advisor for International Disability Rights Judith Heumann, stigma and unequal treatment add to the struggle of disabled people everywhere.
Frequently in countries in Africa and around the world, we see that disabled individuals are highly stigmatized. And that stigmatization, I believe, also is one of the significant causes of people being marginalized. When people do not believe that disabled individuals are capable of making meaningful contributions to their communities, then they're not necessarily looking at the types of laws and programs that need to be put in place.
Heumann says that some African nations have made progress. Kenya recently hosted the first General Assembly of the African Disability Forum, and Ethiopia's new light rail system in the capital was built with disability access in mind. But, she says, more African governments need to look at ways to put their money where their mouths are. One step, she suggests, is that governments look at hiring and promoting qualified people with disabilities to important positions. In 2010, she says, U.S. President Barack Obama issued an executive order calling for a closer look at disabled government employees. The result, she says, is that more and more disabled employees have joined the federal ranks.
I think it's very important to be willing to listen to what civil society is saying in relationship to stigma and marginalization that they may be facing, and for the government itself to play a very proactive role in appointing disabled people to important positions, looking at the government itself to look at what it can be doing to hire more disabled individuals.
And she says African governments should focus on the big picture, by improving education, social services, and healthcare, even working to become better stewards of the environment. These issues don't just affect the disabled, she says. They affect us all. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24-7, visit our website at VOA Africa. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Kurt Bynum. Thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Today, at the very beginning of a new millennium, the world faces what Deputy Secretary of State Antony Blinken called a threat that does not stop at borders and does not distinguish among its victims. In every corner of the globe, in every country represented here today in ways big and small, violent extremists have left their mark, murdering, terrorizing, and preaching an ideology of nihilism and fear that seeks to defy humanity. These remarks came at a high-level event on preventing violent extremism through education, organized by the UN Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, or UNESCO, and the permanent mission of the United States during the 38th General Conference at UNESCO headquarters. Deputy Secretary Blinken added, "Our weapon of choice in this fight is a weapon surpassing any that extremists possess, one that delivers a blow that no agent of hate or intolerance can withstand. It is the bright light of education." In the words of UNESCO Director General Irina Bokova, "Violent extremists offer destruction and hatred. We must respond with culture and knowledge. Violent extremists promote fear and division. We must respond with skills for critical thinking, with opportunities for civic engagement, with competences for dialogue across cultures." UNESCO has a program available to ministries that request it called Global Citizenship Education. It helps create a learning environment that promotes a free exchange of ideas. The hope is to raise a generation of responsible global citizens by instilling in students a respect for human rights, social justice, diversity, gender equality, and environmental sustainability. Building on this program, the United States will take the next step and help develop a digital education resource to prevent and undermine the allure of violent extremism. By arming young minds with a world perspective rooted in respect, social justice, diversity, and critical thinking, we can counter radicalization as it arises and even prevent its growth in the first place, said Deputy Secretary Blinken. By investing in their future, we secure ours. The alternative is too tragic to even contemplate. Without a quality education, these children are in danger of being exploited, forced to work, pressured into early marriage, conscripted as child soldiers, or become prey to the siren song of violent extremism.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impuga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
escape from the humdrum and dance to the beat of an African drum. Hi, I am David Van, host of the Voice of America's African Beat. Splendid sounds from the continent that all humanity calls home. Join me Monday through Friday at 0900 and 2000 UTC for a soothing musical journey. I guarantee it.